Now, President Bush is standing by Alberto Gonzalez as political pressure increases to oust the attorney general because of the way he handled the firing of 8 U.S. attorneys. The president phoned Gonzalez this morning to assure him that his job was safe. Meanwhile, those 3,000 pages of emails and documents regarding the firings and released by the Justice Department last night are revealing more. Joining us is Steph Stern of Congressional Quarterly. And Seth, first of all, to the president's phone call, despite that call, what is the political pressure from Gonzalez to step down?
Well, there's nothing in the documents that directly implicate Gonzalez. He apparently doesn't use email himself, but there are sort of more and more little indications that the senior members of the Justice Department, particularly the Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty, knew more about and were more involved than they've suggested.
Well, there was a secondary issue with Gonzalez as well, and that was his plan to replace the fired prosecutors using a little noticed provision in the Patriot Act. Now, Congress is considering that today. What are the questions?
The Senate today actually voting right now on a measure that would return the language to before the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act allows a provision in the Patriot Act allows the Attorney General to appoint interim U.S. attorneys for an indefinite period of time. The measure the Senate's voting on, sponsored by Dianne Feinstein of California, would return it to the previous language where the Attorney General could appoint an interim U.S. attorney for 120 days, and then a federal judge in that district, once the 120 days had expired, would then appoint the interim.
Well, because Gonzalez is being accused of using the provision in the Patriot Act to appoint new attorney generals without Senate confirmation, here's Senate Democrat Charles Schumer speaking about that earlier today.
How can citizens not be cynical when it's clear the Patriot Act was cynically manipulated to bypass checks and balances? We all know that politics plays a role in the Justice Department, but it should be second to rule of law. And on too many issues in this Justice Department, politics came first and rule of law came second.
Well, Seth Stern, did a use of the Patriot Act for political reasons come up in any of the documents that were released last night?
Yes, there is an email from Kyle Sampson, who is serving as the Attorney General's Chief of Staff, and there's language in it referring to using this interim appointment authority as a way to sort of bypass home state senators, that they could avoid having to give them deference. So that's sort of a needling that I'm sure Senate Democrats, it's only going to increase their anger once they flag that.
Well, also among the documents was a chart used to rank prosecutors. And to many people's surprise, it showed that Patrick Fitzgerald, the man, of course, we know who prosecuted Scooter Libby in the CIA leak trial, but also received an award for being one of the top prosecutors because of his pursuit of criminal cases against Al-Qaeda's terrorist network. He only received a middle-of-the-road ranking. What's been the response to that?
Well, I don't believe it's in the documents that was released. The Washington Post reported that is among the sort of redacted sections that the Justice Department didn't give up. But that's only going to fuel fire and the sense that these are sort of a political targeting of prosecutors. I mean, he's also the prosecutor going after the Scooter Libby in that prosecution. So the sense that they're specifically targeting prosecutors who are investigating corruption charges against Republicans.
Well, there were 3,000 pages of papers and a lot of sleepy journalists. In about the minute we have, what jumped at you so far?
What really strikes me, and this is more sort of just sort of the emotional dimension, the U.S. attorney in Michigan, the sort of pleading tone of her emails saying, I can't afford to lose this job. Please extend me or find me another job in the Justice Department. And then once senior Justice Department officials say it's performance related, she sends Paul McNulty sort of a desperate email saying, you've got to reject that. You can't accuse me of poor performance. So it really, you see sort of the strain and the toll that this took on the 8 targeted prosecutors.
Right. Seth, one last question. A question of whether White House advisor Karl Rove and former White House counsel Harriet Myers will eventually testify. You're right, that's becoming a legal showdown over executive privilege in the seconds we have. Are we likely to see those senior officials testify?
You're likely to see some sort of negotiation. What usually happens here is the two sides blink, particularly when there's a lot of political pressure. It might not be in a public hearing, but you're likely to see some sort of accommodation if the history of these things is any guide.
Seth Stern of Congressional Quarterly bringing us the latest on the investigation into the dismissals of 8 U.S. attorneys by the Bush administration Justice Department. Seth, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, we want to focus for a few minutes today on the law and American schools. Now, in 1896, the case Plessy versus Ferguson ruled that American schools could be separate but equal. In 1954, Brown versus the Board of Education declared separate but equal unconstitutional. Then there was the case you may never have heard of, Sheff versus O'Neill. In 1989, 19 families, led by lawyer John Britton, argued that their Hartford, Connecticut schools were not only still segregated, separate, but still unequal because of social engineering and the lack of affordable housing that in the 50s corralled minority kids in the dying cities and white middle-class kids in the newly built suburbs. Well, researcher Susan Eaton tells the story of that case and a parallel story of a modern-day class in her ambitious new book, The Children of Room E4. In Miss Luddy's third-grade class at Simpson-Waverly Elementary School in Hartford, Room E4, Susan met Jeremy Otero, a bright 8-year-old who dodges stray bullets and drug deals to get to his beloved school. He's only seen the nearby wealthy suburb of West Hartford once, driving in a social worker's car. After seeing the neat lawns and big houses, he tells author Eaton, "I couldn't believe it was really a true thing." What happens when America's kids, white and black, grow up in two different worlds? Susan's findings are disturbing, and she joins us in the studio with more. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
It's not just the story of Jeremy. It's as if there's just layers and layers and layers and layers of Hartford that Jeremy is standing upon. It's a history of redlining, white flight, failed industry, creating segregated communities. Touch on that briefly.
The situation that we have now in our urban areas and places like Hartford and sections of Boston all around the country are a legacy of, the shorthand answer is racial discrimination, a confluence of factors that have come together over decades to create the situation that we're in now.
For instance, real estate agents who wouldn't show white people homes in neighborhoods that were turning black or the other way around.
That's right. There's been tests that have been done by advocacy groups and then later by journalists as late as the early 1990s that showed vast discrimination, differential treatment for African Americans and for Latinos, in the case of Hartford, particularly Puerto Rican families.
Well, but is there anything overt?
In some cases, there was certainly overt racism. But in a lot of other cases, it was a little bit more complex and a little bit more subtle. For example, we had federal housing policies that encouraged the building of affordable housing in places where poor people already were. And then around the same time, we had suburban legislators standing up at a podium and fighting against a solution that would regionalize housing policies. You know, you'd have the challenges of poverty spread out over one large region instead of the way that it exists now, in which we've got poor people kind of corralled into one small area. I mean, meanwhile, we had suburban communities that were built around the cities that wouldn't have never have been built if it weren't for the city. And yet, when it came to dealing with social problems or the challenges of racial inequality, the suburbs considered themselves exempt.
How did all of this affect schools?
Basically, the school district lines and the boundaries are based upon match municipal boundaries. Then if you have a segregated city and town, you're going to have segregated schools. So, for example, the school that I write about, Simpson-Waverly Elementary School, did not become segregated over time because of white flight. It opened in 1970 in a segregated neighborhood, and so it was 100% black the day that it opened its doors in 1970. You know, the argument of the plaintiffs in the case, Sheff v. O'Neill, was that the state is responsible for providing an equal educational opportunity to all of its children. And now we've got a situation in which schools, for a variety of very complicated reasons, we have separate schools, generally speaking, for African-American and increasingly for Latino students, and those schools are not equal either. Their argument was that the segregation and the concentrated poverty that characterize the schools in the city of Hartford and all across this nation deprive students of the equal educational opportunity that is guaranteed as a right in the state constitution.
They were saying this of the black students, but they went further to say that it's also depriving white students of a diverse education.
At the time, that was a novel way to approach this issue. Since the Sheff case was filed in 1989, there's been a lot of research that bears that point out, that white students, middle-class students, benefit from a racially diverse classroom.
An executive from Aetna, now Hartford is the insurance capital of the world, or was, comes in and says what?
His name was Buddy Foster, and he had been someone who very early on had been promoting diversity in Aetna. And so he started many programs in which Hartford students would come and they'd learn computer skills, they'd learn public speaking skills. But when he was actually questioned on the witness stand, John Britton said, well, do you end up hiring these kids? And he says, we really don't. And he was embarrassed and sheepishly said, these children just, they live in a world that is so different from the culture that's expected in a place like Aetna. There's absolutely no way, no matter how fiercely intelligent and bright and ambitious they would be, they're just so ill-prepared to function in this type of environment.
Because they'd been schooled separately.
They haven't been exposed. If you grow up in a middle-class environment, you go to a middle-class school, you go to a college campus, you learn, you absorb, you pick up without even knowing, you
right.
know, that you're learning.
We go back to a little, you know, third grader, Jeremy Otero, who sees a wealthy neighborhood, glimpses it through the window of a car and says, I couldn't believe it was really a true thing. There's another scene, the teacher that you met who took a group of children out to a river.
Yeah, they went over the bridge. There's a teacher who testifies in the case, Gladys mm-hmm. Hernandez, who explains her experience of taking these lovely children on a field trip. And as they're going over the Connecticut River, which, mind you, is about maybe a half a mile from their homes, they begin to cheer and applaud because they're so struck by the beauty of this river, the kind of place that we would go by and we wouldn't even notice because it's so commonplace. And then more than a decade later, I'm with Miss Lois Luddy, the teacher who I write about, and Jeremy and his classmates, and we are going out to a field trip. And what happens? I couldn't believe this was actually happening. We went by the Connecticut River, you know, this muddy, polluted portion of the river that's trickling through cement barriers, and the children are ecstatic, screaming, yelling, pressing their faces against the window, and amazed that there was this river. Later, we passed a beautiful, picturesque pond, and a few of the children asked whether or not that was the ocean.
Well, that's breaking my heart.
Yeah, I mean, and then we expect these kids should make it through high school and then are ready to compete on a college campus.
That's Susan Eaton, author of The Children in Room E4. Her new book looks at the Connecticut case, the 90s Sheff versus O'Neill, that charged that inner-city kids were getting separate and unequal educations because of other factors, like when federal school aid was doled out, rich suburbs got as much as the inner cities, even though the suburbs propped up their schools with high property taxes. Well, since that case, many studies have shown the harm of essentially two different school systems in the U.S. So what to do about it? Whatever happened to Jeremy? And what happened to the case? We'll have more with Susan Eaton after the news break here and now. Now, and we're back with Susan Eaton. Her new book is The Children in Room E4, the story of a classroom and a court case in urban Hartford. We heard the plaintiff's side that schools were separate and unequal. The state of Connecticut in defense argued that segregation and poverty did exist, but that wasn't the state's fault. The state won in 1995, and to celebrate, then-Governor Rowland popped champagne corks. How did people in Hartford's inner city feel about that?
People were shocked and amazed that their winning this case was celebrated as a kind of sports victory. And I remember John Britton saying to me, you know, what are we celebrating here, that we still have segregated schools? But the most stunning thing to me at the time was the governor was interviewed by a reporter for the Hartford Current and asked, you know, well, what does this ruling show? And he said that this shows that segregation is just a result of personal choice, of people wanting to, choosing to live where they want to live. It just flies in the face of everything that we know about urban history. I could imagine how dispirited the lawyers must have felt at that moment, but instead they decided that same day that they would appeal the decision.
And they did. They went to the state Supreme Court with an appeal, and they did eventually win. But during the Supreme Court's considerations, one of the justices asked, what do you want? If Bill Gates walked in here right now and put millions in to make things spectacular, is that the answer? And it wasn't the answer.
I remember that moment in the Supreme Court when the lawyer who was making the argument, Wes Horton, she said, would you still, if he came in and gave you all this money and everything became perfect and beautiful, would you still be here? And he didn't miss a beat. He said, absolutely, yes, we would still be here. Because this system in which there's a world of children who are basically apart from the bigger, more mainstream, more powerful world creates an inherent inequality.
So what is the answer? Because you, as you write, the schools in Hartford are more segregated than ever before. You know, if that's the case, that it's about the diversity, it's about being able to interact with kids of other backgrounds, it sounds like busing's the only answer.
No, and I think that word busing gets a really bad connotation. A bus is just a mode of transportation. I mean, first of all, there are a lot of things that we can do to reduce the segregation and concentrated poverty, of making your housing policies fairer, to ensuring that people in lower income neighborhoods might have access to predominantly middle class neighborhoods so they're not forced to live in concentrated poverty.
Build more affordable housing in wealthy suburbs.
Well, that and also ensuring that people have choices, that they can get subsidized housing in other areas as well. I don't think that it makes sense, and this is not on anybody's civil rights agenda, to mandatorily bus students from one place to another. That's just not on the table.
Well, meanwhile, you write about Ms. Luddy's class. This is Jeremy's, sounds like just terrific teacher. She goes and visits, as you do, the suburb of Marlborough and the schools there and partners students. What happens with that?
Well, this is a very interesting program that she started, and the idea was that urban teachers and suburban teachers would get together and their kids would meet each other and kind of hang out and do a fun activity together. Now, this program meant that the children twice a year would go out to the suburban town called Marlborough. It was an all-white school, and then twice a year the students from Marlborough would come to Simpson-Waverly. And it sounds like a sweet little innocent program, but if you think about it in a larger context, we are living in such separate worlds that children have to get on a bus and go to a field trip to see the suburbs as if they're going to a museum or to a zoo. They have pen pal programs with kids in the suburbs. To truly understand what's going on in the urban area, you can't do it without going and spending some time in a suburban third grade. And the differences were deeply troubling.
Just give us a few.
First of all, just the basic culture of the school. There's an assumption in the urban school that if you don't get these kids to sit down and be quiet and stay in line, then all hell is going to break loose. Whereas in the suburban environment, children are much freer. They're allowed to, for example, talk to each other in the halls as they're passing to class. Certainly during lunch period, they're allowed to laugh, sing.
Well, we could go on.
Yeah, we could go on and on about the testing, the drilling, the no recess, for example, all that stuff.
You said to us that you think one of the only solutions is that we somehow change the whole infrastructure so that there are more people of lower incomes who are able to live in neighborhoods so that the walls are broken down, that right now, as you say, corral kids in certain areas, and that is really truly the only way to change the educational system. But that's a long ways away, and we've got Jeremy.
That's right. It is a long ways away.
This incredible third grader, bright as a light bulb and just so charismatic. Is he going to make it?
Well, he will, because this writer came into his classroom and made sure that he got into this private school. But so it's not a systematic, you know, solution for poverty, unfortunately. But some of the other kids in his class, you know, I'm in touch with a few of them, and some of them give me hope. But then I remember, you know, for example, this one boy, Patrick, who was an incredibly gifted writer. I mean, I'd read the things that he wrote, and I would just be floored. And my first reaction to him was, I want to write a book with this child because he's so brilliant and sees so many things that I can't see. And the state's reaction to him was, you know, that he was below or needs improvement in his writing because he wasn't following, you know, the certain form that that they gave him in the writing assignment. So many examples of kids who had enormous potential that wasn't going to get tapped. And it wasn't going to get tapped because they were headed for a middle school that was dangerous, that was often locked down during the day because of crime in the outside neighborhood where there were gang problems, and to a high school in spite of all the hard work of the educators that were there, was very, very difficult environment to get even basic learning done.
So what's the short-term solution?
I think the short-term solution is any kind of program or policy that connects disenfranchised children to the larger mainstream society is really important. And for the help to work, it has to last. We have to stay with a child at, you know, age 3 and all the way through. And we have to somehow look at every program and every policy. And my first question is, does this connect kids who aren't connected?
Susan Eaton, the author of The Children in Room E4. Susan is also research director at the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at Harvard University. Susan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
More ahead, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now.
Here and Now. Members of Congress are scheduled to vote this week on a House measure to provide $124 billion in additional war funding. The measure also sets an August 31, 2008 deadline to bring troops home, and bring them home even faster if the Iraqi government fails to meet certain benchmarks. Because of that provision, and because the White House says a good $25 billion of the bill is for non-war spending, the president is threatening to veto it, and many lawmakers are nervous about it. Well, one congressman from Oregon is floating a different war funding idea, a lump sum, $500 billion, and when it's reached, a cutoff of spending for the war in Iraq. Joining us from Washington is Oregon Congressman David Wu. He's a member of the centrist New Democrat Coalition. He was first elected in 1998. He's up for re-election next year. And he was one of 133 members of the House of Representatives who voted against the 2002 resolution authorizing the use of force in Iraq. Congressman, welcome.
Good to be with you, Robin.
Let's talk about this bill. Spending already on the war in Iraq, according to the Congressional Budget Office, is already at $350 billion. You're saying, if we're doing the math correctly, allow a $500 billion cap. That's about $150 billion more for Iraq. The House bill, for instance, would be $95 billion or so on both Iraq and Afghanistan. So you're saying authorize more spending that's even in the House bill today, but then not a penny more than that. Have we got that right?
The numbers are roughly correct. Some people say $350 billion have been spent already. Other estimates run to about $400 billion. And I think the concept is the cap. That is, capping it at a certain level, and the executive branch should be tasked with getting us out in a responsible manner, in a business-like manner. This is how a business would budget for extricating itself, say, from a failed merger or acquisition.
But Congressman, what do you say to your constituents who may also have been completely against the war, but now worry that a cap, that a pullout, would mean the collapse of a country that the U.S. broke? Even 85% of MoveOn.org members reportedly are for the House bill, which again would authorize increased spending. So what do you say to those people who say, might have been with you 4 years ago, but are saying, now it's broken and we can't leave it?
Well, first of all, this is not a cap at current levels. This is not the money runs out today. This is a lot of money. This is $150 billion more. And I believe that the executive branch, in spending $150 billion, can leave Iraq in a responsible manner. You know, the same people who are saying that we have nothing but the power of the purse to just completely cut off funding, they're just wrong historically.
We should say that you devised this with Bruce Ackerman, a professor of law and political science at Yale. As you said, you believe it's backed in law, but I still go back to, you know, the practicality of it. For instance, the measure the House is going to vote on this week is
one would say, controversial enough. It's been criticized for being loaded with funding for pet projects in lawmakers' home states in order to get them on board. It's expected to be rejected in both the Senate and by the White House. So given the controversy over that measure, how do you expect yours to get much legs?
Well, let me say this, that Congressman John Murtha's effort to craft an emergency supplemental appropriations bill and to protect our troops is absolutely commendable. Troops have been redeployed, they have been deployed repeatedly without being rested, retrained, and up to readiness standards. And to not protect our troops is an abuse of our citizen soldiers. It is an abuse of power. The Constitution expressly gives the Congress the ability to regulate the military. Those words are in the U.S. Constitution, and the bill that's going to be on the floor later on this week, it should be stripped of those other pork provisions, if you will, but the core Iraq provisions are sound.
Some would say the fact that the pork is there is an illustration of just how nervous some lawmakers are about getting on board with this. And I just, you know, we'd asked you
about... you're not talking with a nervous lawmaker right now.
Well, you know, we'd asked you about, you know, how do you feel about constituents, and we know there are many in Oregon who might have been against the war, but fear pulling out now would further jeopardize the area. But then you also have constituents who want the U.S. out right now. Do you also, I mean, are you kind of caught between these two groups? Because you are, as you said, your bill would authorize $150 billion more in spending.
We are faced with very, very tough decisions now, and even tougher than when we got into this unnecessary war in the first place. The administration just needs to be turned around to look at the facts. You know, George Santayana famously said that fanaticism is redoubling your effort when you've forgotten your aim. And let's take a rough measure of our efforts and our aims in Iraq. After great effort, Saddam is dead. After long effort, we've established there are no WMD, and we have eliminated Iraq as a state threat to its neighbors. We've achieved all the president's war aims. Why are we sending more troops there?
Well, as you all know, the White House would respond that it would be unconscionable to pull troops. It would place freedom and democracy in Iraq at grave risk and embolden our enemies. This is how they are speaking of the House spending measure. You've heard what the White House has said, but I want to know, how will you vote on...
Robin, I just wouldn't trust folks who have taken 4 years to dig us into the hole that we're in right now. I think it's time to change our thinking on this.
Well, your proposal is one thing. It's been put out for discussion. But how will you vote on the actual bill that the House is considering this week?
It is not a comfortable vote, but I, at this time, intend to vote for it.
Not comfortable because...
My preference would be to be out of Iraq yesterday. This bill funds the war for a significant period longer. It does have some deadlines in it, but I will be voting for it, not with enthusiasm, but because it at least takes one or two steps in the proper direction of easing us out of Iraq.
Congressman Wu, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Robin, thank you very much. I think that a thorough discussion of topics like this is very, very, very important. And, you know, I knocked on a lot of doors in 2002. I knock on doors in election years and in non-election years. But I'll tell you what, in August of 2002, nobody on the doorstep in Oregon said, hey, Iraq is a terrible threat. We need to invade Iraq. I'll tell you what's happening with my folks at home, and I think this is happening around the country. People know that we're off, you know, we're off in the weeds. We are not in the right place. But folks are very, very uncomfortable with the various proposals about how to proceed forward because all the options are bad. And Iraq, you know, could have problems whether we're there or not. If they really become a threat to their neighbors, terrorism-wise, or if there's millions dying of genocide, we might have to send our troops back, and that's going to be a much harder thing to do.
Democrat David Wu, he represents Oregon's 1st District in the U.S. House of Representatives. He's proposing a cap on spending in Iraq. You're listening to Here and Now. Today, Tuesday, March 20th, marks the official beginning of the fifth year of the war in Iraq, so we have a question for you. So far, the U.S. engagement in Iraq has lasted longer than its involvement in which of the following wars? A, World War I, B, World War II, C, the Vietnam War, or D, the Civil War? Well, that question was posed by The Globalist, a Washington-based research organization that promotes awareness of world affairs, and their Globalist quiz is printed in newspapers in 20 countries in 12 languages. Joining us is the group's publisher and editor-in-chief, Stefan Richter. And Stefan, it's kind of not fair because this question we just asked had many answers. What are the answers?
Well, let's take it step by step. Let's compare it first to World War I. That war, of course, lasted over 4 years at the time, but the U.S. only got into the game late and was militarily engaged in World War I for 19 months.
So the Iraq War has lasted longer than the U.S. involvement in World War I.
Way more than double as long.
Okay.
Exactly.
World War II.
World War II, the U.S. was involved much longer, even though not for the whole time again. It got involved in December 41. And was there, wouldn't you guess it, only for 44 months.
So the Iraq War involvement longer than World War II.
Since November of 2006, we've been there longer than in the entire Second World War.
But the Vietnam War.
Now that's the big one. People tend to forget it, but the U.S. engagement in that U.S.-started war with another insurgency, so to speak, started in 1965, in the spring, and ended only 8 years later. So the U.S. was involved for 96 months altogether, and that, of course, is double as long as we've been in Iraq so far, and it might foreshadow also some of the length that will take before the troops will finally be out, even in an optimistic scenario.
The Civil War, go on to that.
Well, that's, of course, the bloodiest war in U.S. history. That war cost 600,000 American lives, and it lasted exactly 4 years. So, in effect, what we're marking today with the beginning of the fifth year of the Iraq War is that we're leaving the entire bloody mess of the Civil War in terms of the time duration behind us, and we're getting into post-Civil War military engagement length in this case.
Well, you also point out in the Globalist quiz that the American Revolutionary War lasted for 8 years and 2 months.
Which raises an interesting point. Because, you know, we always talk about insurgents in Iraq. And if you ask, you know, some of them are terrorists, but some of them are also freedom fighters for their own domestic situation. If you ask some of them where they got their revolutionary zest to oppose a force from abroad, they would well point out that they got it from the American revolutionaries that tried to do away with British oppression. Way back then, way back when.
And Stefan, before we let you go, we want to take a look at another Globalist quiz question. It's about measuring the cost of war, mm-hmm. of course, beyond the human toll. The financial costs of U.S. military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan have reached, according to the Congressional Budget Office, $454 billion. What do you compare that to?
Here's the upshot. Because the war has by now cost, as you have mentioned, $454 billion, we're at a point where all U.S. development aid, that's all the money that's spent on all the 120 developing countries in the world, the poorest of the poor, everything that we've spent all year back to the year 1965, that is over 40 years of development aid to all the poor countries, that's the same amount of money that we've given to them over those four decades that we have spent in the few years in the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. And if you look at the World Bank, that organization that gives loans to the poor countries, we're going to be back to all the loans. Mind you, loans are something that these poor countries have to pay back. All the loans that the World Bank has given since 1982, that takes us back to the beginning of the Reagan administration. All the loans given by the World Bank, all the rich countries, to all the poor countries, same amount, $450 billion. These numbers really give us plenty of reason to sit down and reflect at the family table, dinner table tonight. The fourth anniversary that we mark tonight, we should think about the exorbitant costs that we have already run up in this war, the virtually unprecedented costs.
Stefan Richter, publisher and editor-in-chief of the Washington-based research group, The Globalist. To see all of their quizzes, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Well, just ahead, our last story. Who took the Vermeer here and now? here and now. On St. Patrick's Day weekend 1990, two thieves posing as Boston police pulled off the largest art heist in American history. The target was the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum here in Boston, a small, beautiful palazzo filled with one passionate collector's treasures. Three Rembrandts, five Degas, and a Monet were among those stolen. Also missing, the Concert by Vermeer, considered now to be the most valuable work of stolen art in the world. Well, documentary filmmaker Rebecca Dreyfuss loved that painting, and that led her to call fine art detective Harold Smith, a call which prompted him to get back on the case.
Hi, Rebecca. After thinking it over, I'm just wondering why we wouldn't take this great opportunity, now that you're making this film, to go after these Gardner paintings. Since this step, I'd wake up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning wondering where these paintings are. And it would seem that this would be a great opportunity to really try and locate them.
One of many cell phone messages in Rebecca's new art-drenched documentary. It's a caper film, really, as her camera follows Harry from Boston to London looking for the artwork and recreates the life of the museum's founder, Isabella Stewart Gardner, as she travels the globe buying that artwork 100 years ago. The cast expands to include museum guards, reformed art thieves, investigative journalists, and heartbroken art historians. The film is called Stolen. It airs tonight on PBS's Independent Lens series. And director Rebecca Dreyfuss joins us now from the Argo Network in New York with more. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
You know, we're reminded this heist was such an offense to people here in Boston. Do you think that has something to do with the intimacy of Isabella Stewart Gardner's museum?
I think it does. I mean, it's a very subjective question in a way, but it certainly seems like there was something personal about the crime, because the Gardner Museum is such a small place and it's so much Mrs. Gardner's creation. Anybody that knows the museum and knows it all, the history of Mrs. Gardner, knows that that was sort of her work of art in a way.
As we said, one of the pieces that was stolen was Vermeer's The Concert. It's a painting that shows a young girl playing, what would that be, a harpsichord?
A harpsichord, yes.
A harpsichord with another woman standing with her arm outstretched, singing. You quote an art historian as saying, for the world to lose that moment when that girl's hand was just dangling mid-sentence is a crime.
You know, many people say, don't you think that's a bit overdramatic with all the things going on in the world? But in fact, Vermeer, for many people, is such an important painter. And one of the things that people often speak about in connection with his paintings is that he was so able to convey the sense of a moment. And, you know, moments are these very precious things, and his rendering of a particular moment is so priceless. Right. So it's kind of a funny quote that you're picking out of the whole film, because one of the more controversial ones.
That is funny, because I did love it, and I think your film does go on to explain why, and especially in the person of Harold Smith, who is the detective that you hook up with in his bowler hat with his eye patch and his terrible skin cancer. Normally, perhaps someone that you'd look away from in a film, but you make him the centerpiece of your film.
He was very passionate about recovering stolen art. It's what he had done his whole life. And I called him to see if he would give me an interview for the film. And that's what I was thinking. I would have one kind of expert interview with him. But when he found out what we were doing, he literally started calling us every day after we met him and talking about, well, what could we do? You know, you heard the message at the beginning. Shortly after we met, you know, he called and said, don't you think we should take this opportunity to look for the paintings?
Well, what I loved about him, too, first of all, his passion and his dignity. You don't, after a while, see his disfigurement. And he, as he travels and very, you know, quietly and firmly investigates this story with your camera right behind him, he does start to feel that he has the same passion that Isabella Gardner had when she went and bought them in the first place.
And I definitely felt that way. You know, at a certain point when I was making the film, I realized that there were a lot of similarities between Harold and Isabella, even though outwardly they're so completely different. They were united in their passion for art, and I realized that that can really sort of cut across boundaries.
Well, the calls start pouring into Harry's answering machine when the museum raises its reward for information from $1 million to $5 million. At one point, he hears from art and antiques dealer William Youngworth, a character who's also had connections with art theft. Then an ex-con calls, and Harry sends him the money to fly to New York because he's supposed to hand off the Vermeer on the steps of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. You're there. You wait. Let's listen to Harry when he realizes he's been conned.
I'm feeling depressed for many reasons. It was very difficult to get here today under very difficult conditions and on a very difficult day in my life. And yesterday was Christmas, and we spent most of the day on the telephone talking about a robbery. And today was my anniversary, and I was up at 2 o'clock in the morning trying to get to New York to be taken by a con artist. So that doesn't make you feel like $1 million. But there's an old saying, and this too shall pass. And that's what's going to happen here. We're still going to get these paintings back.
As filmmakers, we watched Harold kind of break his own rule. You know, you never pay for information. You never give out money before you have artwork. You know, we were sort of watching a character study in a way, which is that here's a man who was breaking his own rule, and it was really because in his heart he just wanted to get the paintings back so much.
Right. Because time is running out for him. He has this terrible cancer.
I think that was part of it. I think he sort of felt like that, you know, he had recovered so much art in his life, and this is the biggest unsolved case, and I think there was just a part of him that was really driven to leave that behind him.
Well, then you both follow a lead connecting the paintings to the IRA, the Irish Republican Army. One art historian says the IRA has a thing for Vermeer. And then you meet a reformed art thief in England called the Turbocharger.
Let's just assume these are bad guys have got them or someone's holding them, and that the IRA, or the Republican movement...
He believes absolutely that the connection is to the IRA through Whitey Bulger, who is the now fugitive Boston Mafia boss, who had strong ties to the IRA, and it was revealed in the late 80s. He was exposed as an FBI informant, and the FBI was in charge of the investigation of the heist. So what was the suggestion as to how they should be returned?
Well, what's suggested by Turbocharger and other people in the film is not even necessarily that they're responsible for the crime, but that they could use their influence to a good end.
Their influence and their desire to be respected. At this point.
Yeah, and to sort of transcend their reputation as, you know, not being a legitimate organization and use this as an opportunity to show that they want to be, you know, a peaceful organization working on the right side of the law and to use their influence to help see this art recovered.
Well, and at this point in the film, it sort of comes to an abrupt halt because, among other things, Harry dies. Does the answer to the question, where are the paintings, does it also... end with Harry? Does it go with Harry?
I don't think so. I mean, I think one of the things that he had hoped was, you know, regardless of whether he himself found the paintings or not, that this film, our film, Stolen, would revive public interest or just kind of remind people. And I think people really do care about this artwork and seeing it recovered, and that it's important to the world in a way, even with everything going on right now.
Documentary filmmaker Rebecca Dreifuss, her film Stolen begins airing tonight on PBS's Independent Lens series. For listings, you can go to our website, here-now.org, and you can see the pictures there as well. Rebecca, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And what a lovely man that Harry was. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.